Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week, our scientific director, Megan Hall, interviews Kira Fury. Kira earned two undergraduate degrees, one in biological science and another in dance from UC Santa Barbara in 2018. She spent time dancing professionally in New York City and is currently working on a research project with a medical doctor working on addiction in Los Angeles, California. Her interdisciplinary background, personal experience with injuries, yoga teaching, and research have given her a specific interest in integrative medicine, which she hopes to implement in her future medical practice. In this interview, Megan talks with Kira about the series of injuries that led to her interest in physical therapy and later to medicine, influenced heavily by the prevalence of eating disorders and the health at every size movement. Kira discusses her current plans to bring prevention and wellness aspects to a medical practice while promoting a body positive environment. She also describes thin privilege, an aspect of the current medical system that many of us take for granted. Just before we get into this week's interview with Megan and Kira, I'd like to extend thanks to the kind folk who support Nourish Balance Thrive on Patreon for helping to make this content possible. Supporting us on Patreon comes with perks, including access to our expert moderated forum. Twice now, each week, our scientific director, Megan Hall, takes questions from the forum and answers them in a live office hour session on Zoom. Last week in office hours, Megan answered your questions. In the Tuesday session, fat-soluble vitamin C, and the effects of a high-protein diet on mTOR, blood glucose, and insulin, probiotics causing detox or die-off symptoms, keto versus paleo versus high-carb or low-fat, things to consider when choosing the best diet. Then in the Thursday session, Megan answered your questions on the safety and nutrient bioavailability of raw meat, greens supplement drinks like Athletic Greens and Cow and Garden vegetable powders, also the Gundry supplements, the types, causes, and treatments of excessive sweating, the curious tale of a disagreement between Thorn and the supplement testing company Labdoor. If you search for Office Hours on the forum, you'll find the link to the video replay together with excellent notes, including all the citations. Just this week, I added an audio feed for Office Hours, and so if you go to the forum, you'll find the URL to add Office Hours to your favorite podcast app. If you currently don't have access to the forum, consider supporting Nourish Balance Thrive on Patreon. If, like me, you're currently out walking the dogs or riding your bike just now, I'll email you later this week with the link to support us on Patreon. If you're not already receiving the podcast show notes by email from me, open a browser and go to mbt.link and you can sign up there. Thanks again for your support. Now over to this week's interview with Megan and Kira.
Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Megan Hall and today I'm delighted to be joined by Kira Fury. Kira, how are you this morning? And did I say your last name right?
Yes, you said my last name right. And I'm good, thanks. I'm really happy to be here.
Good. Well, I'm really excited to speak with you. First, I'd like to give listeners just a little bit of background. So you and I connected a handful of months back, if I'm not mistaken, to chat about medical school. As many people know, I went through the process of taking all of my pre-med classes, applying to medical school, and then I decided to continue my work with Nourish Balance Thrive rather than pursue medical school. Anyway, that's kind of a long story. This podcast isn't about me, it's about you. But when Kira and I spoke, I was really impressed about how she was thinking and also excited that I'd found somewhat of a kindred spirit in somebody who is young with aspirations of entering the conventional medical field, but with knowledge and appreciation of the importance of ancestral health and also a desire to make change from inside the system. So today, I think the plan is to talk a little bit about her path to medicine, some of her less conventional views about health and what it means, and then dive into how she'd like to implement these concepts into her future practice as a physician. Does that sound good?
Yes, that sounds great.
Okay, awesome. So let's start with your path to medicine. Can you talk a little bit about that? I know that there was an injury somewhere involved somewhere along the way that played a large role in your decision. Is that right?
Yeah, totally. So when I was 12, well, I guess I should start with saying that when I was 4, I started dancing. So that's always been a big part of my life. And when I was 12, I was diagnosed with a chronic foot injury. And I remember that doctor's appointment very clearly. They told me that I had to stop most physical activity, which is a really big part of my life. And I was either given the option to get surgery or to do physical therapy. And at the time, neither of those had a great prospect for my recovery. So I was sent to a physical therapist. His name was Jeff, and he had 10 years of experience working with dancers, which was really lucky for me. So kind of after 6 months of working together, I had over an hour of physical therapy that I had to do every night, which I did very diligently. And I thought it was so cool that I was able to do these exercises and strengthen different muscles, and I was able to heal and eventually get back to dance, which was really amazing for me. So after that, I was really dead set on being a physical therapist, and I thought, this is what I want to do. So then after that, I went, well, I guess there was a long time gap after that. And then upon entering college, I kind of thought, okay, I'm going to be a physical therapist. So I always loved science. I always wanted to understand kind of why things happened and how they happened. I had a million questions, much to my parents and some of my teachers in school's dismay. And so I did this internship where I worked with the Division I athletes at sporting events and in the athletic training room. And I got to work with physical therapists. I got to work with sports medicine doctors, and I was really surprised because I really liked what the doctors were doing more than the physical therapists. So I thought it was a lot more interesting to understand why things were happening than kind of fixing the mechanics. And that's not to say, like, I still have a huge appreciation for what physical therapists do. It's just that for me personally, kind of like figuring out why it was happening and diagnosing things was much more interesting. And so that's kind of when I switched from thinking, okay, maybe I would like being a doctor a little bit better.
That's awesome. Could you talk just a little bit more about the nature of your injury and then also how you ended up solving the problem from, it sounds like, multiple perspectives? I know that a lot of times in athletes or active individuals, one injury kind of causes another, and it can be a little bit difficult to maybe find which injury caused the problem in the first place. And taking kind of a systems approach to injury recovery and prevention can be a really kind of beneficial thing. So I guess another way to put this was, what was the root cause of the injury, or do you know?
Yeah, so the cause of my injury is, of my foot injury, is I have this tiny little extra bone on the side of my foot. And so we all have a bone there, but I have a tiny little extra one, and it's actually in both feet, but for some reason where it falls on my right foot, it falls at a particular place over the tendon that is particularly irritating, I guess. And it's really common. It's, I guess, happens in approximately 10% of people, but only gets commonly diagnosed in dancers and gymnasts because of the nature of the activity. So I'm sorry, I'm forgetting what your exact question was. Like, how exactly did we solve it?
Yeah, I was wondering because it sounds like there were kind of, we talked about a hip injury as well before, but right, everything probably stems from some kind of root cause injury. Is that right? I would assume.
Like, is my hip injury related to my foot injury?
Yeah.
No, that's a different thing. But my hip injury is a better example of a systems approach than my foot injury, to be honest.
Okay, well then, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, there are so many injuries. Yeah, but my hip injury is a lot more recent. So for that one, what happened was probably, gosh, my junior year of high school, I was doing an audition and I just felt like this twinge happened in my back, and I kind of like thought nothing of it because in dance, it's kind of like, oh yeah, everybody has pain. You just keep on dealing with it, which I'm sure is common in a lot of athletic fields. And then it started to affect me a lot. So I went to a doctor. They did tests. They said nothing was wrong. I saw my chiropractor. They said nothing was wrong. So then I just kept dancing and it got worse. Then I went to college. Kind of the same thing. I saw different doctors. They said nothing was wrong. My dance teachers told me to work through it. And everything just kept getting a lot worse until I got to New York. And then at that point, it had been 5 years. And finally, I got an MRI, and then they found a labrum tear in my left hip. So then we did treatment for the labrum tear, because like when you have a labrum tear, there's kind of like routine symptoms. You have this like deep popping, you have different pain, all of that I was having. So those symptoms went away, but then I was still having like other pain and weird symptoms. And I went to this. So when I was in New York, I have Kaiser for my healthcare. There's no Kaiser in the state of New York. And so then I went to a physician, or I took a train, a 3-hour train ride to Washington, D.C., because that's the closest Kaiser, to see a doctor there, because I was like still having symptoms. And he refused to look at my MRI. And then he told me, well, you don't have a labrum tear. And I was like, well, could you please just look at my MRI? And he was like, well, your symptoms don't match with it. And I was like, okay, well, what do you think is going on? And he was just like, well, you can't have this because this doesn't match up and you can't have this. And so I just left like feeling really confused and defeated. And then eventually I came back to California, and I have the good fortune of my mom is a neuropsychologist that works in a sports medicine facility. And so I have access to a lot of really good doctors there. And so I got to see kind of like a sports medicine doctor who worked with a pelvic floor specialist, who worked with a physical therapist, and eventually a physiatrist, which is like a whole team of people. And they kind of took another look at my MRI and did a whole systems approach. And like, even though the labrum tear was a factor, it wasn't the only thing. And like, this is getting long, so I apologize. But basically, that's okay. It's like, because there was a labrum tear that was untreated for so long, that caused my muscle mechanics to be off, which caused all these other issues and compensated for things and compressed nerves, caused inflammation, yada, yada. So a whole host of other issues that I guess then all those things have to be treated. So you can't just like treat the labrum tear and then expect all those other things to go away, if that makes sense. And I guess to me, that speaks to so many things that it's like, okay, well, if somebody had just listened to me at the beginning, my treatment would have been a lot simpler. But then I also think it speaks to like, I have so much respect for that the team of people that figured all of that out, because the human body is so complex that it's not so easy to figure out like, well, what's going on here? Because especially if you look like at the inside of somebody's hip, so many things come together there that like, I know that that was not an easy thing to figure out.
Wow. That's quite the story.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that integrative systems approach that the ultimate medical team helped you with, I would guess kind of helped you, or maybe this is a leading question, but did that help you with your decision of transitioning from wanting to be a PT to wanting to go into the field of medical practice?
Yeah, it most definitely did. I would say that experience like really solidified it for me, because when I was in New York, for sure, I felt really like alone and probably kind of like angry with the medical field. And having that experience made me feel like, okay, there are people who care. And it also like, I think from a young age, and even now when I feel like upset or when I'm just having a bad day, like as cheesy as this may sound, the one thing that kind of grounds me is like, I think about how amazing the human body is. And like, even right now here, as we're talking, like my cells are doing all these crazy, amazing things that I don't even have to control, you know? And so it was like, even though like my body is kind of messed up right now, it's kind of cool that they're able to like, look at how all these things connect and fix that. And I want to do that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that I'm intrigued with the complexity and the amazingness of the human body as well. And I also kind of want to point out that I think that empathy, which is a really important thing in healthcare, which is, I think, oftentimes severely lacking sometimes. And there's a great Brené Brown YouTube video on empathy that we'll link to in the show notes. It sounds like with your past injuries, and I'm sure other areas of your life, as you're a physician, you'll be able to be a more empathetic physician, which I think is really important as well.
Thanks for saying that. That's something really important to me. I love that video. The one you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a good one. And also, I know you talked a little bit about the influence of psychology. So I was wondering, and I know that you're a yoga teacher, right?
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about psychology and yoga and how that's also transformed some of your thinking as far as what medicine is?
Yeah, totally. Let's see. Well, I would say, so I started yoga my second year of college as a purely physical practice, partly because I took my passion for exercise, let's just say, a little too far in college, and my body was not so happy with me. So yoga was a kind of gentler way to approach that. And then I took a break from yoga and I was like, I don't feel that great anymore. And I was like, so then I started practicing yoga more regularly and I got certified and I learned a lot more about the mental perspective of yoga. And I think that it helped that there is a lot more science and literature coming out about meditation and all of those benefits. And then I started to just be a lot more interested in, I guess, kind of, I don't know, how to live a more fulfilled life, because I think that the first year of college was really hard for me and really stressful. And I was so focused on like getting the grades and succeeding and da 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 da. And it was like, okay, well, now I did all these things, but I'm really not that happy. So that's kind of when I started listening to, honestly, the Minimalist podcast, which is how I found Nourish, Balance, Thrive and how we connected. And that's when I started learning about Brené Brown and all of these other people. And then to me, like, Western psychology and yoga are like two sides of the same coin. And I guess I have such a hard time seeing how those things are separate from medicine, I guess, because to me it's like, well, here's my brain and then there's my spinal cord and there's my body and they're all connected. And then our brain is also the thing that regulates the hormones which direct our body to do all these different processes. So I think that psychology is so important, and I know that there's, I don't know if a stigma is the right word, but I know that some people in medicine think like, oh, well, this is like woo-woo stuff. And like, I am all for science, please, like all of that, you know, but I just think that it's really important to kind of integrate mental health and physical health into just like overall health.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that a while back at Nourish, Balance, Thrive, we brought on Dr. Simon Marshall onto the team, and he's a brilliant sports and performance psychologist. And I can't tell you how many clients have benefited from speaking with him while simultaneously working with health coaches, me, Clay, and Zach, to reach their health and performance goals. And I'm really not quite sure how we managed without him before he was on the team. He's just an invaluable member. So I absolutely agree that everything from the neck up is really not just from the neck up, it's affecting everything from the neck down as well. And from a psychological perspective, that can kind of transitioning into talking about prevention, that can, things like yoga, things like meditation, I'm sure can be used from a primary perspective and also probably from a secondary perspective as well. And I know you have some thoughts and you've been involved in some research on the area of prevention. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. So right now I'm working on a research project with a very brilliant physician. His name is Jeff Wilkins, and he's an addiction medicine specialist. He's based in LA, and we're working to put together a systematic review of primary prevention efforts, primarily for adolescents, but also kind of dabbling into children and young adults for alcohol, tobacco, and other drug use. And it was interesting when him and I first spoke, he told me that there has been some resistance towards primary prevention in his field.
Could you just very briefly, for the listeners, define primary versus secondary prevention?
Yes, of course. It was new to me too, because I was like, well, prevention just means one thing, right? No, but it doesn't. So primary prevention is stopping, or I guess, let me start over. Okay. Primary prevention is preventing a problem before it happens. So it's kind of like stopping somebody from ever trying the drug. Whereas secondary prevention is like, okay, somebody has already tried the drug or is already starting to show signs of dependence. Now, how can we like lessen the impact or stop it from getting worse or like treating it? Yeah. So I was not surprised when he told me that, but I was really interested to have a conversation about it, I guess, because it really aligns with my views on the healthcare system as it stands right now, and even as it relates right to like how we talked about my hip injury, because it kind of seems like we have a reactive healthcare system where it's like we only treat things once they become a really big problem. And I don't really think that that is doctors, like the fault of physicians. I think that that is how our healthcare system is set up and how insurance companies are set up. And I think that's really unfortunate for patients. I think it's unfortunate for doctors. And I could talk about that. That could be a whole nother podcast. But anyway, so yeah, the research that we're doing is right now, I guess it's kind of like two simultaneous projects going on, but we're looking at a bunch of literature, looking at a lot of different clinical trials and other reviews of different intervention programs that have happened with adolescents, mainly for prevention efforts, primary prevention efforts. For sometimes it's all substances, sometimes it's a specific substance, and usually they are a combination of factors, and it's not always, it's almost never just like, let me give you an education about drugs. It's usually a combination of, can I give this person family support? Can I give them some sort of education? Can we give them community support? And also helping people in school. And I would say an interesting thing is, like, lack of connectedness is a very big problem. And I think that's interesting. Also, I don't know if you're familiar with, like, 12-step literature, but lack of connection is usually the biggest factor playing into addiction of any kind. And I think that there is a really big problem with that in our world today. We're more connected than ever and also more lonely than ever. And then the other thing we're doing is that Dr. Wilkins is kind of involved with this Boys and Girls Club that is in a kind of depressed economy, a Latin Hispanic community in LA. And he has already been involved in kind of seeing kids already through that started out when they were like in second grade that have made it all the way through college. And a lot of these kids drop out when they're in high school and they don't even make it through college. And so then we're going to try and put in some evidence-based practices to help prevent them from even ever trying drugs, things like that, to kind of like help in their academic success, help in them getting through college, because they have the extra barriers of maybe like their siblings are in gangs or their parents do drugs or things like that.
That's fascinating. I know we've talked a lot about loneliness and social isolation and lack of connectedness here on the podcast, but it's interesting to see or hear from the perspective of like a drug and alcohol abuse, that also plays a role, and it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so anything else about kind of your path to medicine you want to talk about? I know we also wanted to touch a little bit about the Health at Every Size idea. So do you want to transition into that?
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
Okay, awesome. So I don't think this has ever been talked about on the podcast before, at least to my knowledge. So do you want to kind of introduce the topic and then tell us a little bit about it and your thoughts?
Yes.
And also, maybe we should start with how I know there are certain people, Linda Bacon maybe, who have written a lot and spoken a lot about this. So did somebody in particular introduce you to the topic?
Yeah. So let's see. What was my path into this? I would say it started with reading Intuitive Eating by Elise Rush. And then a dietitian actually recommended to me the book Body Respect, which talks about the Health at Every Size movement. How did you get introduced into it?
I think I just heard about it from some podcasts and reading a little bit.
Oh.
But I haven't actually read any of those particular books yet.
Oh, okay. I would highly recommend Body Respect, especially because like I am not one for, as much as I love psychology and yoga and I think self-compassion and those things are important and I work on them, I am not a big self-love, like those books are really hard for me. And so if you hear the title like Body Respect, you might think like I can't handle that, but it's very like science-based. So
that's great.
It's a really good book. So Health at Every Size. So I just read something really interesting the other day that said, and I think this is a common misconception, health at every size does not mean that everyone at every size is healthy, but it just means that anyone in any body can be healthy. So basically just that the way that you look or your weight or does not define your health, which I think is a very common misconception. So yeah, Linda Bacon is basically the person who has pioneered this movement, and it is based in science. There is one study in particular that stood out to me that she did. And that was a study where they basically followed two groups of women. And I am not going to have the full details for you right now, but I could probably find like the article and give it to you, and you could put it in the link if you would like.
That'd be great.
Yeah. And one of the groups of women did a traditional American, not American diet, but like what we would think of as like a restrictive diet and exercise plan. And they followed them for like at least a year. It might have been 2 years. And then the other women were encouraged to do intuitive eating, to eat what they wanted, to practice self-compassion, all those things. So the people that went on the more restrictive diet and exercised lost weight at the beginning, and then they gained all the weight back, as is shown, because we know 95% of diets don't work. And it's like, would you take a pill from your doctor that 95% of the time didn't work? I don't think so. Then the other group, they didn't lose any weight, but in both groups, they measured like their blood lipids and did their labs and all these different things, which I believe you guys do some of those things at Nourish Balance Thrive. And so these health markers, the women who dieted did not get better, but the women who did the health at every size approach markedly improved. So I think the idea is that in this body shaming idea of like, you need to go on a diet, you need to lose weight, da 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 da, we are not improving people's health. And so it's like, maybe some people could be healthier if they ate a different way or if they moved more, but in shaming people, we are not helping them at all. And the current paradigm that we have around that in most of society is not helping. And there is actually a lot of people that it's hurting. So in the book Body Respect, there is a lot of research on weight bias in the healthcare system. And there, I personally can't talk about this. So you and I, Megan, we would have what is called thin privilege, right? So if you and I go to the doctor and we say, oh, my knee hurts, the doctor is not going to say to us, well, you need to go on a diet. But for somebody who might live in a larger body, that might be what the doctor says. And instead of telling them like, oh, let's get some imaging, let's do this, let's do that. And I don't think that's fair. So there's a lot of that. And there are a lot of people that live in larger bodies that are afraid to go to the doctor. There are all these things. And then there's the jarring statistic that somebody is 292 times more likely to have an eating disorder than to get diabetes. But what do we hear about all the time? The diabetes epidemic, the obesity epidemic. But really, eating disorders are so much more damaging. And I'm pretty sure that like anorexia is one of the most deadly mental health disorders. So I just think that maybe the conversation on this needs to shift.
Sure. And by shifting, kind of thinking about health versus thinking about body size and body weight.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think, though, that diet culture is so sneaky and that it changes, right? Now we hear like, oh, healthy and lifestyle, but then we're sold this idea that healthy is like working out and counting your calories and doing these things. And really, like, is it that healthy if you're stressing out about it all the time? And I think people joking now about making these big deals about like gaining weight during the pandemic, you know, it's like that's damaging to a lot of people and a lot of people are struggling. And so like, maybe don't do that. Like maybe there are other things that you could focus on.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a pretty crazy statistics about eating disorders and diabetes. I didn't know about that. Anything you want to say about BMI? Because I know that that can be a little bit controversial. And from like a, I guess, a research perspective at a population level, maybe it's a good measure or marker to look at. Maybe, I don't know. Some people would probably disagree with that, but at a like individual level, I know that it's very much not a great health marker. So any thoughts on that?
Yes. So many thoughts on that. I would say that I understand the need to have some sort of standardized marker, and I don't have the answer for what a good one would be. However, I don't think BMI is useful at all, and I think it does more harm than good. So Linda Bacon talks about this in the book Body Respect, and BMI was determined a long time ago, and it was determined basically by a company that was backed by a big pharmaceutical company who at the time had the only weight loss drugs on the market. So they had a vested interest in getting people to buy weight loss drugs. And so if people think, okay, I need to lose weight to be healthy, then they will spend money on these drugs and then Big Pharma will make money. And there is actually research from the CDC showing that people who fall in the overweight category, and for people that aren't familiar, CDC is Center for Disease Control, people that fall in the quote-unquote overweight category live longer than people in the quote-unquote normal category, and people in the quote-unquote moderately obese category live just as long as people in the quote-unquote normal category. So the CDC published these results and then basically said, but like, don't listen to us, for no good scientific reason, which they would not do about something else, which just shows you how much bias and like issues there are in our society. But the BMI selection has literally no scientific backing between deciding what category is overweight, what category is normal. There are no risk factors deciding those numbers. They were just decided indiscriminately by non-science people who had a vested interest in making money off of the drugs that they were selling. And the people that made up the BMI scale literally said that they should not be used as diagnostic characteristics. So that's how I feel about those.
Wow. That's a lot of good information. I actually wasn't aware of like the history of how BMI came to be. So that's really good to know.
Yeah.
Cool. So let's kind of transition now into how you plan to implement some of these concepts of, say, health at every size and integrative medicine into your future practice as a physician.
Okay.
Because right now, I don't know if we mentioned this, but Kira is in the process of applying to medical school. Very exciting.
Yes, very exciting and very nerve-wracking. Well, I think it's important to mention that, like, I'm aware that my plans now are probably going to change somewhat by the time that I'm actually having a practice. And I know by the time I know that I have to put in my time, you know, I'm not just going to like graduate medical school and all of a sudden like have a private practice. But I do have, I don't think my convictions are going to change, and I don't think my goals will, my core beliefs, I don't think will change, you know?
Yeah,
so
for sure.
With that disclaimer, I definitely don't want to weigh my patients, because I know that's a thing that a lot of people dread. And I know that's even a reason why a lot of people don't go to the doctor. So that's a big thing for me. I really hope to do my residency at an integrative center. There are a lot more medical schools implementing integrative kind of programs and things. I know like UCLA has a center for East and West medicine, which is really cool. And there are a lot of other ones. And then I have a lot of different friends that are in different specialties in healthcare. And so my dream is to one day co-found an integrative center where there would be like physical therapists, there would be therapists, neuropsychologists, there would be yoga and kind of like people doing mindful movement, maybe Qigong, kind of gentle nutrition, and where people could come and get everything. So it doesn't feel like, well, I have to go here for this and here for that. And it feels like all of the treatment is working cohesively together rather than kind of in disparate places. And then something else that's really important to me is that I would like to hopefully be successful enough that I'm able to charge on a sliding scale. I know that right now a lot of private entities, or most private entities, don't really accept insurance. And honestly, I'm hoping that as a result of everything going on right now, we might see some changes in how healthcare and insurance work, so that maybe we could have more support for everybody so that healthcare is more accessible. But I don't want to only be able to serve really rich people. So yeah, those are my dreams.
No, those are absolutely fantastic. I think that accessibility to this kind of healthcare that you're talking about is going to be really critical for the future of human health. So I really hope that you're able to find ways to do this as a physician. I think that's really important. And also, I had a dream of putting together an integrative health center as well when I was on the track to med school years ago. So it would be fantastic if you could open something like that that has professionals of all different disciplines accessible to people, and also communicating together about patients. So it seems to me, in my experience, that interdisciplinary communication between medical professionals seems to be somewhat of a lost art these days. So if your integrative medical practice could have physicians communicating with each other about clients or patients, you know, that's even better for the patient. I think they would be able to get healthier if they had that team approach.
Totally. And I think, like, back to what we were saying about my hip, right? Like, that's what allowed me to get better, you know? And I think that's kind of what you guys have at Nourish Balance Thrive, if I'm correct, which is what made me so interested. I was like, that's what I want to do.
Well, I'm glad you reached out and I'm glad we connected. So one last thing I wanted to kind of talk about or ask you was, some of these things that we've talked about today are a little bit controversial with conventional medicine practitioners or people kind of that have more of a conventional approach. It seems like a lot of the medical students that are coming up these days or the pre-med students or people wanting to get into the health field are a little bit more open-minded, which is great. But do you expect pushback from your colleagues? And what do you, if anything, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, what do you plan to do about that? Other than surrounding yourself with this team of people who seem to be like-minded, which I think is great. And I think when we first spoke, we talked about Physicians for Ancestral Health, which is a great group of like-minded physicians, MDs and DOs, that Dr. Tommy Wood, Dr. Josh Turknet, many others are part of. So maybe surrounding yourself with people would be part of that plan to combat some negativity that comes in around your thoughts. Because while they are great thoughts, I think that you will get some pushback.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think, yeah, I have already experienced feedback or pushback in the application process. I was quite frankly even nervous to record a podcast with you because I was like, oh my gosh, are medical schools going to like be upset at my unstatus quo thoughts? But quite frankly, I have never been a person that fit neatly into a box. And I think I've received pushback in a lot of areas of my life. And that hasn't ever been a thing that I've been willing to like let stop me, if that makes sense. So I think that, I guess throughout medical school, this is a good question, Megan.
Maybe it's one that you think about and come back on the podcast later and talk about. But just, you know, if you have thoughts now, I would love to hear any of them that you do have.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that there are going to for sure be ups and downs. Like there, for me, this relates a lot to double majoring in college because I don't know if I mentioned this already in our conversation right now, but I double majored in dance and biology, which is a really uncommon double major. And a lot of advisors and a lot of people told me that that was something I couldn't do. And if I was going to do, then I wouldn't be successful in X, Y, and Z. And there were a lot of moments throughout my whole college career when I thought, like, what am I doing? Whatever. And that is one of the things that I am most proud of now. But it was really, really hard. And so I kind of think this is going to be the same thing. So I guess part of it is going to be continuing to remind myself, why am I doing this? What am I passionate about? What am I hoping to achieve? I think for me, listening to, honestly, podcasts of like-minded people and books and things that I find inspiring and people that are farther along in the field to kind of counter the more negative messages that I am also going to hear of people telling me, you can't do this, and what do you, like, you're so naive, or like, how like silly of you to think that you can do this. And then I think also finding those supportive communities of people that are like-minded. I think what you said, Physicians for Ancestral Health, and focusing on those. And then I think I also have a few mentors in my life, actually, literally, who I just talked to 2 days ago because I was feeling really bogged down in the whole application process, both in the medical field and not in the medical field, who really believe in me and see me as like Kira, you know, for lack of a better explanation. And just kind of speaking with them is also very helpful in moments when I'm feeling really doubtful.
That's great. So I would absolutely encourage you to continue to seek those mentorships and those relationships of people who are like-minded. So be ready for the pushback, but I have a lot of hope and confidence that you'll succeed.
Thanks, Megan.
Of course. Is there anything else that we missed that you'd like to touch on about anything at all? Can be related to anything we talked about, not related?
I don't think so. Unless you have any questions for me that I didn't answer.
I don't think so. I think we've covered a lot of great things, and it's been a really wonderful conversation. A large part of what I was hoping to do here, one, was expose you to our listeners, and two, is to provide some inspiration to other pre-med students or individuals considering going into medicine through more of the conventional route, and show them that there are others who are passionate about looking at health from a different perspective, thinking more about preventing diseases before they manifest versus just treating them, and also desiring to change the system from within, one patient interaction at a time. So thank you so much for taking the time to join me today, and hopefully we'll be hearing more from you and what you're doing in the years to come, and I wish you the best of luck in medical school.
Thanks, Megan.